You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, April 10th, 2026. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. April 18th, 2026, Rabble.ca will celebrate 25 years of sharing news for the rest of us. Ahead of our birthday celebration, Rabble publisher Sarah Sahagian sits down with Rabble founder Judy Rebick to hear about the creation of Rabble all those years ago, why it was so important and still is to be a progressive, feminist, independent news source, and where Rabble should go next. Here are Judy Rebick and Sarah Sahagian in conversation. Take a listen.
So, Judy, it is so nice that you could sit with us today. It is an honor to talk to Judy Rebick about the founding of Rabble.ca. What inspired you to found Rabble.ca in 2001, 25 years ago, before we really even had many news websites? This was a pioneering news website, especially in the progressive community.
Well, I was working for the CBC. I had a show called Straight from the Hip, I think is when I had Straight from the Hip, which was a women's panel discussion. And the CBC just started a website, okay? And the brass at the CBC didn't pay any attention to it because then nobody understood what the internet would become. And the guys who were running it were lefties, so they asked me if I'd write a column on the website. I don't think the brass at the CBC would have been happy about that. But anyway, I did. And I guess it was the second column I wrote was on the war in Kosovo. And I was against the war in Kosovo. And nobody else in the mainstream media, hardly anyone internationally, was against the war in Kosovo. And so my column got a lot of attention. And I got 200 emails. We didn't have social media then. I got 200 emails. Now, that doesn't sound like that much now, although it is a lot. But back then, if you wrote, I was a mainstream journalist. I mean, I wrote for the Globe and Mail. I wrote for the Star. If I got like five letters to the editor, it'd be a lot. And I got 200 emails, and they were most of the people agreeing with me, thanking me for writing it, but also they were quite intelligent, and even the ones that disagreed with me made a good argument. And at the time, I was involved with a group of people who were trying to start an independent, what we would have called then an alternative national newspaper. So we had like things like Guerrilla, which was a local in Toronto, and each different cities had different newspapers. And they had $1 million and it wasn't enough. So I thought, this might be a good place to start a national news, left-wing newspaper. And I used to speak a lot across the country then. And so every place that I went, I asked the alternative newspaper people to set up a meeting for me and make sure that half the people were under 30 because younger people understood the medium better. And I suggested this idea. At the time, we thought of it as an online newspaper. And all the young people said the same thing. They said, if it's not interactive, we're not interested. And I said, what do you mean? And you say, well, we want to talk. We don't care what experts think. We want to talk to people like us and see what they think. Okay. And so I got a taste of social media, you know. I mean, I saw, okay, there's a need for this for young people. And so we created what I believe was the first social media site in North America. There was another one that Zenet did, but it was much more just hardline lefties fighting with each other. But this was, you know, if you look at my columns on the Rabble website in the archives, you'll see that I talk to people who used to come up to me and introduce themselves as babblers. Okay, we had the babble, right? And so that's what inspired me, was that experience and then those meetings. And at the time, there was a lot happening. It was the kind of rise of the anti-globalization movement, right? And so, you know, the battle in Seattle, right, was a big sign of that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So you created this news website, Rabble, with a corresponding social media component that we no longer have, but was really innovative at the time, Babbel. And so can you tell me, when you created this, when you launched in April of 2001, what was the reception like?
It was immediately popular. And the reason, because we had a great strategy, which was I worked as a journalist, but always an opinion journalist. I've never been a reporter except for that day. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it was the day that we had a big march in Quebec City against the FTAA, the Free Trade of the Americas was meeting in Quebec City. And there was a huge march. And I reported on it from the streets of Quebec City. And it was very violent. Like, the cops were so violent that day. That was the most violent I've ever seen police at a demonstration before or since. And I was there and reporting on it. Now, we couldn't type right onto the internet, that everything had to be coded. So I would phone in my stories. And ZNet picked it up in the States. And we were the only ones reporting from the streets and the only ones reporting from the perspective of the demonstrators. So we immediately had a huge audience. I can't give you the figures, but we immediately had a big audience because of that. The other thing I want to say is that when I started Rabble, I decided to hire all women because the internet, I had a sense of the power of the internet because of this experience, and it was all men dominating it. So I hired a woman editor, I hired a woman managing editor, I hired a woman, what we called then webmaster, we called her a web mistress, right? All women, it was an all-women staff, and that was pretty radical too.
And so you have this big site, it's becoming incredibly popular, you're covering important news stories. So it seems like there was a lot of success really quickly. Do you recall any challenges that you had in the early years?
The challenge was that I spent all my time raising money. That's why I finally left, because, I mean, I was good at raising money, but I really thought I had better things to do than raise money. So once I found somebody, Kim Elliott, who could do it, that's when I left. And I think it was challenging because we tried to run it as a collective kind of thing, like not top down. And we didn't really, I don't think we were very skilled at doing that. I certainly wasn't. I didn't like being a boss, which is why I was quite determined to do it that way. Yeah, I think that was a challenge. I don't really remember other challenges. It was a lot of work. Yeah, it was a lot of work.
What was your favorite thing about working with Rabble and founding Rabble?
Well, I had worked in the mainstream media for about 6 years, mm-hmm. in CBC. And of course, when you work in the mainstream media, you know, you have a lot of limits on what you can do and say. I mean, not that we paid attention to all of those, but it, you know, you're restricted, right? But here we were creating something new, influencing others, because I think it was because of us that unions started to get traffic to their websites and then started to pay more attention to the internet. And also, I guess the thing now, I feel like it was a real privilege to be in on the bottom floor of this massive new communication system, which at least initially gave the left a voice, enabled the left to have its own voice on a mass scale. I mean, the right took it over and the mainstream took it over very quickly. But in the time that I was there, and then the other thing is it let me do things like anti.com, you know, that were really fun. Like I created a character, anti.com, and I was an advice column, like to the lovelorn, you know, because I do have a good sense of humor. I mean, maybe if I hadn't been who I am, I would have been a stand-up comic, you know, because I love doing that. And that was really fun. Or Real Women, which I did with Kathy Bond, which was, you know, women reviewing movies, and she really liked, we both really liked action movies. So we often would review action movies from a feminist perspective. So we did a lot of fun things as well as the serious stuff. And yeah, so I think that it was, for me, I guess, a way of using what I'd learned as a journalist, because like I say, I'd worked now for, you know, whatever, 6 years as a mainstream journalist, and put it and combined it with my radical politics and find a way to, you know, because I knew that the notion, the mainstream journalist notion of objective was bullshit, that basically that was the perspective of the elites. But then how do you write good journalism that's fair? And that's what we were exploring. And that was, I thought that was really, I found that really liberating.
And so much of what you did was at the forefront. I mean, you were just on the cutting edge. When I think about Real Women, it's definitely a precursor to other websites that exist today. I mean, I think I actually wrote for the Cherry Picks when I was a little bit younger, which was a feminist film site that was supposed to kind of provide a counterpoint to Rotten Tomatoes.
Right. counterpoint to Rotten Tomatoes.
And I mean, and what I love is that you guys were doing all these things that later even more people came to the internet to do. So it really was very innovative what you were doing.
Yeah, it was
terrible. Yeah, you kind of predicted all the things that would become popular on the internet.
Yeah, too bad I wasn't into making money. Like my brother said, if you'd been into making money, we'd all be rich now, you know?
Yeah.
I wasn't into it making money. And, you know, because both Tanya Sermon and Mark Sermon, they both wanted us to have paid advertisement, but I wouldn't have that. I don't want us to be part of the capitalist system, right? So yeah, we didn't do that. I really put the kibosh on that. But you know, there are other things. Like I remember the day we were sitting around having an editorial meeting, because in those days, you know, we actually had an office. Mm-hmm. And somebody brought in the radio and said, you're not going to believe this. And it was 9/11, right? So that was very challenging. How did we respond to 9/11 as you know, as an activist site, because the Islamophobia after 9/11 was unbelievable.
Yeah,
and we had to deal with that at the same time as, you know, of course, not you know, opposing the attack itself, but really mostly opposing the response to the attack. So, yeah, so there were challenging political things like that. Yeah.
So one thing I'm curious about, from your standpoint, as someone who created one of the world's first progressive media news sites, and a site that has now been around for 25 years, so congratulations on that. I'm curious, what do you think is the future of progressive media? What does progressive media need to do to remain relevant? I mean, because when you founded this site, I mean, when I think about 2001, what a time to found a progressive media site. I mean, you get 9/11, which is such a tricky thing to talk about from a progressive perspective, but it's important to hear progressive views on that. You have the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq that happened in the following years. There was just so much news, the Harper years, all of these things. And you stood there documenting the news. Your team documented the news from a progressive perspective. Obviously, the team at Rabble now would love some advice about what we should do going forward. What do you think progressive media needs to do to stay relevant and to thrive?
Well, I think that more and more, I think, first of all, from the perspective of news, I think it's important to report on demonstrations and struggles. You know, right now there's big issues around equal pay that the media is completely ignoring. It would be good if Rabble could write some stuff on that. And I've noticed there's some columns on that. Giving a voice to people who don't get a voice in the mainstream media through your, and I know you do that through your column. I'd like to see that featured a bit more. And I think that investigative report news is important now more than opinion. The problem with opinion, like when we were doing Rabble in the early days, opinion was important. Now it is important. It's still important, but there's so much opinion and so little fact information that you can rely on. So I think being a reliable news source and covering movement stuff and union stuff, I see you are doing that around the unions, is really important from a critical perspective. And that's the other thing. Like, you know, you have to be fair when you're a journalist. That I agree with. You have to look at all sides of an issue. But objectivity is a bullshit notion that just imposes elite perspectives. And so you don't have to be objective. You can go in with a point of view as long as you show the other side. And we've sort of forgotten that somehow. It's like an either or, right? Either you just print straight the fact or you argue your position and there's nothing in between. And I don't think that's true. Like when I was on the streets of Quebec City, you know, I had a point of view. I was with the protesters, right? I wasn't with the police. I was with the protesters, right? And nobody else was with the protesters. And in a way, nobody else is with the protesters, right? And so I think that's important. I think it's important to show the perspective of people who are fighting for change.
Absolutely. And what you said, it's interesting about how objectivity really privileges the elites. And in order to be fair, you show the other side, but you can still have your own perspective. That reminds me of what I learned in my master's in gender studies. That's very, I think it comes from feminist philosophy. And I know that you were at the forefront of that and you were having those conversations. So yeah. Is that where you learned that approach to objectivity? I'm just curious.
No, I learned it by being a journalist and being a left-wing journalist.
Okay? Absolutely.
Yeah, and I learned it very young because, you know, I worked on the McGill Daily in 1960, that's how old I am, right? And I was really into journalism. So when I came to Toronto, I got freelance jobs. And I realized that I couldn't write the world that I saw. They wouldn't let me, right? Like, just for an example, I wrote a piece for Star Weekly, which was then the big magazine. It was a national magazine. And it was about people living together without being married, which in 1967 was a very shocking thing. And the Peter Zosky was the editor, and he said to me, you can get people to, like, let their picture be taken? You know, like, that's how shocked he was, right? And, you know, I could write that piece because I was saying something that nobody knew, people didn't know was happening. But if I wanted to write a piece about something that I cared about, they wouldn't let me. They wouldn't let me write it the way I wanted to. Or they wouldn't take the pieces. Like, for example, I had worked in my last year, I won't say this too often publicly, but my last year at McGill, I was broke. My father went broke and I had no money and I was desperate for work. And I wrote for Midnight Magazine, you know, one of those supermarket tabloids, you know, where they make up everything. You know, they said to me, you know, write a story, person born with no sex organs. And I'd say, that's not possible. Like, okay, they can be born with I knew about intersex, with both sex organs, but they can't be born with no sex. And they say, it doesn't matter, just make it up, right? So I thought it was funny, right? So I was going to write a story exposing how ridiculous this was. And I had a number of really funny stories. And he said, no, I want you to write, like, I was a woman sex writer. That's what he wanted me to write. I was a woman journalist writing about sex. And I wouldn't write that. I mean, I was enough of a I wasn't much of a feminist, but I was, what I knew about feminism, my feminism was just that, you know, I'm just as good as men. That was my feminism, right? Mm-hmm. And I wasn't going to write that. So I thought, the hell with this, you know? So I don't know. Does that help answer your question?
Yeah, that definitely helps.
Yeah, so, and then I went to New York and I couldn't get a job as a journalist because I was a woman. You know, like at 19, when I was trying to get a job as a journalist, which was 1968, it was pretty hard to get a job as a woman journalist.
And then what you did was eventually when you became a journalist, you did this wonderful thing and created a platform where at first you had all women journalists. So that's great,
right.
Transformational leadership.
Well, by that time, women could get work as journalists. You know, it was Michelle Landsberg and Doris Anderson who broke the barriers, not me. It was their generation. They're about 10 years older than me. Their generation that broke the barriers. Yeah.
But it's still hard. It's still hard. The idea of an all-female newsroom. That's pretty much unheard of.
Yeah, that was pretty radical.
I mean, all you have to do is see, I mean, a couple of weeks ago, an email that a Canadian journalist who works in New York named Sachi Cole got from the husband of a woman she profiled went viral because it was so abusive. And I just think that what you did by creating a feminist all-female newsroom is so revolutionary. Even today, women experience some abuse in journalism. So I am
the main thing was I found a female web mistress. Like the journalism part wasn't hard, but finding a web mistress, like, you know what it was to run a website then? You know, because you couldn't type on the internet. You had to code everything, right?
I know.
And
I
so
know.
You had to be like a total geek to be able to run a website. And she
but
was.
You did it.
You know?
You did.
I didn't
you
do
did
it. She did it. I thought of it, but she did it. Jane Will is her name. And it was really amazing. And I think, you know, some mainstream media should have written a story about her and about, you know, what she was able to do, because it was amazing, because it wasn't easy. That's for sure.
Well, congratulations on 25 years of Rabble.
Congratulations to you. Thank you for taking up the whatever you say that.
It's
I can't believe it's lasted this long, to tell you the truth.
We are very privileged. We know that the digital media space is a hard place, and lots of wonderful publications that were founded after Rabble and were younger than Rabble are no longer with us. And of course, we mourn those publications, but we are also proud of Rabble's legacy and everything you built. So happy birthday, Rabble.ca.
Happy birthday. I can't believe a quarter century. It's amazing.
A quarter century. Thank you so much for joining us, Judy.
Okay, my pleasure.
Was Rabble founder Judy Rebick and publisher Sarah Sahagian in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Sarah and Judy. And happy birthday, Rabble! To help celebrate our 25th anniversary, consider becoming a donor at rabble.ca/donate. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on rabble.ca. To do that, let's hand things over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week with environmental news. The federal government plans on creating 15 new national urban parks by the year 2030, and Rabble columnist Ole Henriksen had a few recommendations on how best to achieve this ambitious goal. For Henriksen, the government should first prioritize the restoration of natural and local vegetation. As well, the government should invest in placing permanent caretakers within the parks to make sure they can be enjoyed by all. Henriksen hopes that the new urban parks prioritize public access over becoming commercial spaces. So far, no funding has been allocated to the National Urban Parks Project, but Henriksen says that the creation of 15 new urban parks would be a game changer, saying, quote, a national urban park system that includes all Canada's major metropolitan areas would be an unparalleled nature legacy, end quote. In national news, columnist Linda McQuaig argues that for the sake of happiness, Canada should be less economically like the United States. 10 years ago, Canada ranked 5th on the Global Happiness Index. In 2025, Canada had slid all the way down to 25th. Countries at the top of the index are Scandinavian countries, with Finland taking the number one spot. These countries all have low income inequality and strong social safety nets. Meanwhile, countries like Canada and the US continue to report lower and lower levels of happiness. Income inequality in both countries has consistently grown in recent decades, and social programs like the Canadian healthcare system continue to be underfunded. McQuaig says that instead of investing large amounts of federal dollars into the military, Canada should invest in people. Also this week, in an op-ed on Rabble, James Adair argues that new NDP leader Avi Lewis should make a bold change in his party's views on nuclear energy. Adair argues that while older party members have negative views on nuclear power, younger NDP voters see it as a potential way to reduce dependency on fossil fuels and create jobs. Instead of investing this money into private sector development of nuclear energy, Adair says that Avi Lewis should campaign for a publicly owned nuclear power company. Lewis has made public options for groceries, internet, and phone service an important part of his political platform, so why not energy as well? Adair hopes that a publicly run nuclear power company would be more environmentally responsible when it comes to the management of nuclear waste and more equitable when it comes to the cost of providing its energy to the public. Adair writes, quote, Avi has a rare opportunity now to bridge the divide between the anti- and pro-nuclear elements of the party and adopt a model that emphasizes public ownership and control of our nuclear future. He has a chance to nationalize the atom. End quote. In provincial news this week, First Nation groups in Alberta were in court this week over a petition to hold a referendum on separation in that province. The First Nations leaders are arguing that such a referendum would be unconstitutional as it would violate the treaties that they have with the federal government. Treaty 6, 7, and 8 First Nations are asking the courts to block such a petition from being submitted for consideration. Danielle Smith, however, has signaled that she will go ahead with the referendum on separation even if she does not receive a petition with the required number of signatures to put it to a vote. Piikani Chief Troy Knowlton told the media that he met with Danielle Smith in person, saying, quote, I was able to tell her to her face, your separatism agenda is nothing more than a political fantasy. You allow the white supremacists, racists, and bigots to be able to come out of their homes and yell and scream. End quote. And finally, in labor news, Canadian Women's Chamber of Commerce President Nancy Wilson is arguing that the federal government should recognize care work as labor and invest in the infrastructure that supports it. Care work, such as childcare, nursing, and caring for elderly family members, is often done by women and is often not paid very well, if at all. Wilson argues that supporting care work would provide a significant boost to the economy. She says the government should expand income supports for caregivers and families, ensure greater access to education, and continue funding the national $10 a day childcare program to make sure that that program is sustainable in the long term. And as always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. To help support our show, please visit rabble.ca/donate, subscribe to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and now join us over on Patreon for special bonus content. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. Thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music, and thank you to you for tuning into Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you.